Greetings and good evening, everybody, from Nashville, Tennessee. Today is Monday, April 17th. Welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Fraley. It's a rainy day here in Nashville, but everything is in bloom. My guest today is Ward Weems, and Ward is an old friend from the Tennessee State Parks, and he's just retired, I guess, about a year ago. And I thought I'd take
just a little over a year now.
I thought I'd take the opportunity to get with him and to talk about the things that we both enjoy. He has spent a good bit of his career in the state parks. Ward, when did you get started with state parks?
1982. I was 34 at the time, okay. So I had spent 4 years active duty Navy in the late 60s and managed a business, a large record store, and then a number of years in school, but I was coming out of some graduate studies in historical geography in East Tennessee State University when I started at Fort Pillow State Historic Park,
which is way out on the banks of the Mississippi River.
And that's when I learned that you can be in Canada from Johnson City, Tennessee, before you can be in Memphis.
Exactly. And how long were you there at Fort Pillow?
Almost 3 years.
Okay. And you were the first park manager there?
No, but the TORAS system, Tennessee Outdoor Recreation Area system, was kind of changing the pattern of the management. So Robert Henry, who had been a sheriff before, had been the manager a while, but they were moving to the system of historic area supervisors.
With specific training in cultural resources management.
Yes, it required a degree, which not many things did in the field in parks. There were interpretive specialists that required a degree and historic area supervisors, natural area supervisors.
I can remember trying to persuade the Division of Personnel that there was a need for reclassification of some of those decisions there, those positions. They were thinking, well, we got along without that classification up to now. Why do we need it now? So then you went from there to Old Stone Fort.
Yes, those were the two state historic parks, archaeological parks, cultural resource areas anyway, the two that had camping, the only two that had camping until Davy Crockett added that KOA.
Oh, that's right.
Historic park Civil War at Fort Pillow to the archaeological park in Manchester, Old Stone Fort.
Yeah, that's a unique archaeological area and a beautiful little place. For the listeners that have never been down to Manchester to that little park, it's well worth a visit.
It is. Of course, the prehistoric peoples that built the enclosure there were very aware of that unique setting, and that had a special significance to them. I don't think there's any way to around that. But you had two rivers, the Forks of the Duck, draining the Highland Rim Plateau.
Right.
And they come very close together there initially.
Kind of a peninsula.
On the east side. And then they diverge a little bit, and they start to drop off the Highland Rim in a series of falls down each side into deep gorges, and then the rivers join. So they've isolated a highland tableland between the rivers, and that's what American Indians built the long wall-like mounds around, setting apart 50 acres and with in turn parallel mounds on the east side that pointed the summer solstice sunrise. So if you take that mile and a quarter walk around the perimeter of the mounds, you're also going along the cliffs and waterfalls of the two rivers.
Exactly, and with the natural features, the plants and animals there that you
very
would expect.
Nice site, remote seeming site, although close to Manchester, across the interstate from Bonnaroo.
Well, how did you get interested in cultural resources from the beginning?
High school. I had an interest in history really all my life, and some of that was, you know, coming up fascinated with Second World War, being just a post-war baby, and but history interests. But it really started coming together with my first African-American teacher, Miss Rose Carson, in high school.
Up in Johnson City.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And had her for homeroom, but also for history. And it was something that I academically finally seemed to have a knack for.
Excellent.
So, stayed with that.
Now, Ward, I know that recently, I guess a year or two ago, the Tennessee State Park System celebrated its 75th anniversary. Am I correct in saying that? Okay.
That's right.
I remember well that I was the director of state parks when the 50th anniversary was being celebrated.
Right.
And that is, it's amazing to me that that much time has gone past. But I think that partially, I guess, in response to that notable anniversary, you were tasked to do some special investigation into the history of the state park system.
Yes, I wrote an article for the Tennessee Conservationist on my view of the history of state parks. Glad to see that made it out. And then to work on the traveling exhibit for the 75th anniversary.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, it was a series of panels and whatever other experiences we could put with it that traveled across the state. So we had that trailer wrapped, so it was very brightly covered with logos and images on the outside, and we had a really good reaction to that from one end of the state to the other, with opening the trailer where people could go through from one end to the other. And I like to be there whenever I could, talking to people about that, helping them to engage with that history.
Lots of pictures from the early days.
Yeah, and the photos, and trying to touch on some of the philosophies that brought parks about, and what Tennessee parks had been about, and quotes from earlier rangers and managers. A lot of it was visual.
Where are those materials now?
Well, several of the panels have been added to a ranger museum at Henry Horton.
Okay.
So Shane Petty has been working on that as a ranger training center down there, and adding those historic factors to it.
Okay. Now, Tennessee State Parks really got kicked off in like 1937 or so, is that?
Yes.
And it seems like it was the Tennessee Valley Authority and the CCC and the WPA and a bunch of those sorts of agencies involved. Tell us what you can about that.
Well, it was a national push for state parks, a realization that something was needed between city parks, which at that time tended to be formal gardens more formal walking spaces, not necessarily ball fields.
Not playgrounds necessarily. Right.
But something between that and national parks, people were really starting to feel a need for. And part of that was this new feeling of healthiness away from city living or factory work. So it was a part of a health revolution to provide these spaces and outdoor camping experiences, and just a way to get away from environments that people were living in at the time. And then with the Depression era recovery, then that brought a lot of Work Progress Administration and other people that the federal government could employ and put to work for trying to find lands. I did another exhibit on the Cumberland Mountain State Park, which covered a lot of aspects of that, where the Resettlement Administration and the Works Progress Administration and Civilian Conservation Corps were all involved. And you had
Eleanor Roosevelt took that one under her wing personally.
She spoke from the back of a big flatbed truck there.
Right.
But the Cumberland Homesteads then eventually led to the Cumberland Mountain State Park, that was the recreation core of those homesteads.
That homestead, there's kind of a central feature of that homestead, kind of a community center, right at that crossroads there, and just south of Crossville, am I right?
Yeah.
With a tower, which of the Crab Orchard stone for
tower.
Yeah, for people that are driving up that way, it's definitely worthwhile stopping and peeking at.
So you can see the museum in that tower, and then go over to the park and see the museum. The museum and exhibit area there is in a redone CCC building that was a bathhouse. So it's been repurposed, for better or worse. It had to be taken down to the CCC stonework and then rebuilt. But they did a good job with that. And
that's just been in the last couple of years that's been completed. Right. Exactly.
So it was a men's bathhouse on one side, women's on the other, and a roofed but open area in the middle. Now the women's old bathhouse is men's and women's restrooms. Okay. The open area is still used. And the old men's bathhouse has been converted into a nice exhibit hall. So you can watch a video there on those subjects. And there's some nice music recorded on site in that time period playing in the background with the homesteaders playing and singing.
Excellent.
That goes well with the exhibit.
That'd be worth a visit to go up to see that.
Oh, you can.
Absolutely. I guess the Tennessee Valley Authority, in their process of building the dams that they're so famous for, having built Norris Dam and Pickwick and Chickamauga and all the dams along the Tennessee River, in the process of making those projects happen, they acquired a lot more land than they actually needed.
Yeah, I don't know how much foresight was put into that we'll need these recreation bases that maybe can be part of a state park system. I hope they were aware of that. But yeah, a lot of the parks were based on the TVA land, while others were land acquired through.
So Harrison Bay, State Park, Booker T were some of the first to come into the system, mm-hmm. on the basis of being donated from the Tennessee Valley Authority to the state of Tennessee.
And there's several ways to judge what the first park was, and it gets complicated.
Okay.
You know, which was first taken over completely by lease, or which was the first taken over partially from the lease.
All right.
Pickett's in there early, but that went through forestry first.
And okay, so Pickett up in north central Tennessee.
Right, away from TVA, but that was one of the early ones too.
Right. It had
been a forestry recreation site.
Beautiful area to see with the Civilian Conservation Corps cabins that you can still rent and stay in.
Yes.
They're just terrific. So the I remember in the early days of traveling the state in state parks, going into the swimming pool at Harrison Bay, which had been built by the Tennessee Valley Authority, and being overwhelmed by how over-engineered it was built by dam builders. With monumental equipment room, and the pool itself was almost the size of a little lagoon. I don't know if you remember that old pool at Harrison Bay, but
I probably got a glimpse of it. Yeah. But I was hauling the exhibit trailer in there, maybe didn't get a good look.
Well,
sounds amazing.
Some of that pool has been taken out because it was just way too big to manage. Mm-hmm. And
as nice as that could have been initially, I wondered what it would cost eventually to take care of it.
It was just huge. But I say that just to illustrate what's involved when the Tennessee Valley Authority gets involved with the building of something.
Scale.
And of course, then the Park Service, the National Park Service, was involved also with the creation of Fall Creek Falls.
Right, being considered for a national park, and they acquired land. Now that gives it an interesting background, and one that just missed getting into the national park system, didn't quite meet their requirements, but they were very interested in it for a period of time. There's some nice photographs from that period of some of the early construction they were doing, like a small swimming area on one of the creeks that was being built with a little dam. And
well, it had been a CCC camp as well up at Fall Creek Falls. Am I right about that?
Less familiar with that.
Okay. I think so. And some of the group camps that are still being used up there, mm-hmm. have their history in the CCC. Then Fall Creek Falls, of course, was made into a resort park.
Right.
Back in the mid-70s or mid to late 70s. It's my recollection of the timeline along those lines.
What was the first resort park, and the way you remember that?
Well, I don't know. As you talked about, it's interesting. You talked about the TORAS, the Tennessee Art, Outdoor Recreation Area System. The classification of resort park probably was not a classification that they used until the late 70s, but the Paris Landing was built before Fall Creek Falls, if I'm not wrong.
50s?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Of course, Montgomery Bell had an inn and restaurant in the way before Fall Creek Falls. But then they got the idea of a resort park and intentionally built a resort with golf course and all those amenities at Fall Creek Falls. And of course, Norris Dam is one of the early TVA projects, and we have a Tennessee State Park as a result of that.
Right.
And Norris is I think fun because of that Museum of Appalachia that's up there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Rice Irwin's.
Well, or the one that's there on the park.
Oh, on the park.
Yeah.
No, I don't have enough familiarity with that one.
Okay.
To get into that. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, what are your memories of some of the people and individuals involved in the state park system?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some interesting people when I first came in, and you would remember many of them. We got an opportunity to meet not people that were there probably pre-war in the very beginning parks, but they were people that knew those people.
Right.
So we connect back to the early times in parks. And the managers were in a different category than you see them later. When I first started, they still weren't wearing uniforms. You had a sport coat issued, which might have a badge flap for the pocket. Managers didn't go to the in-service training like the Rangers did at that time. So you kind of graduated out of all that when you became a manager. But that began to change pretty quickly after I came in as a manager in 82.
I remember that the park rangers were only really going through the law enforcement training not long before I was there. I mean, Bill Boswell was involved in getting that going.
In 82, when I went through the academy, they were still running sheriff's deputies through that had long been deputies and had never been to the academy.
Right.
So the law had changed where more people had to go through the academy to do that.
Right. Some of the early people that I remember well, one is Jim Robb. I'm sure you remember Jim.
Yes, and he was not directly before me at Old Stone Fort, but he had spent 9 years at the Old Stone Fort after he'd been at Big Ridge, and a tremendous conservationist in person. And I just met him a couple of times, really, but I liked following in his footsteps and some of the things that he had tried to do at Old Stone Fort. And
I remember meeting him at Old Stone Fort when I was trying to assist the city of Manchester with the creation of a park and recreation department. And so we had a delegation of city people go out to the park and out to Stone Fort and talk to them. And Jim met us and took us on a little bit of a hike and did his identification of birds and plants and wildlife, and it was an extraordinarily impressive thing to watch, I can tell you. What a great, great guy. What other of the guys do you remember from the early days?
Well, we soon came to a system of districts, which was new to the park system.
Right.
And I remember a number of those men, and they were some of the ones that went back close to the beginning and knew those people, as I mentioned. Jerry Bird was a Middle Tennessee one, had quite a golf fascination, but couldn't have been a more interesting character, though.
Exactly, I remember Jerry well.
And J.C. Myers, there were a couple of Myers, but this was J.C. Myers from the Warren County area that had managed Rock Island and eventually was out in West Tennessee at Meeman Shelby.
He was stationed at Meeman Shelby, yeah. Exactly.
Let's see. Billy Glenn Smith was a interesting one of the era. And
Now, he was from way up in Upper East Tennessee. Am I correct about that? Yeah. Okay.
What was the colonel that was at Paris Landing?
Oh, gee. I'll not remember his name, but he was superintendent there.
You had to fill out like a military chit to do anything. He was
really
tight ship.
I'll come up with his name here in a minute, but what I remember about him is that he was an excellent marksman.
First name was Luther.
Yes, Luther. Well, I remember, you know, as you well know, the park rangers and people that carry weapons have to train for their weapons on a periodic basis and be certified. And Luther would always take the opportunity to demonstrate his skill at skeet and trap, which was unbelievable. Mm. He would hit 98 out of 100 birds.
Many of those people had completed high school.
That's right.
But like college now, high school is what you could get out of it, and some people got a lot out of it, and some of those people were quite sharp with the high school degrees then. There was a wide range, but some of them were very sharp.
Well, some of the stories are about their thoughtfulness too, and being able to deal with the political aspect of being in a very prominent state job, having a member of the legislature show up to play golf at a particular facility and be drunk and having to deal with, you know, that sort of a situation, and being able to handle it without a big mess being made.
Yes.
We could probably name names on that particular one, but the stories of having to deal with the politicos who would show up at the parks and expect to be treated as royalty, and anyway, there are some fun stories.
And the uniqueness levels of it at Old Stone Fort. Archaeological park, but a separate entrance just down the road, a golf course. So for a decade or so, I had a golf course manager reporting to me as well as managing the archaeological park.
Exactly. You know, and that's an interesting thing. The golf course was essentially to provide people within those two or three counties with a golfing opportunity. It's not the kind of place where someone from Nashville or Memphis would travel to play golf.
Usually not. Yeah. But it had been a private country club, and it was going bankrupt, and they negotiated with the state to kind of bail them out. So
what happened was the state became the recreation manager of last resort. rather than setting up their own park and recreation agencies, which they ended up doing in Manchester,
right.
They went to the state to get it done. Mm-hmm. So do you remember A.J. Anderson?
I do, yeah.
What do you remember about A.J.?
Was he at Cumberland Mountain?
No, he was at Fall Creek.
Oh, yes. And he did date pretty well back in the
Yes,
park.
He did.
I remember some early photographs of him.
You know, A.J.
But he was a person that had to handle a lot of those
exactly.
issues that you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. That's the reason I mentioned that. In 1986, Tennessee was one of the featured states in the National Folklife Festival that's put on an annual basis up in Washington.
Did you say 86?
86.
Then that was the Tennessee homecoming year.
It was part of the homecoming year, mm-hmm. exactly. And I say that because A.J., as well as being a park superintendent of one of the prominent parks, Fall Creek Falls, had a passion for operating a sawmill. And they had a sawmill, and I think it was steam operated, there at the park. And if you went to visit the park, you would never see it. It was just sitting off in a maintenance yard. Mm-hmm. But when trees would fall of nature just fell a tree, he would go out and snag it up and saw it up and use the wood there at the park for various things. Well, we put that sawmill on a tractor trailer and took it up and set it up on the mall as part of the celebration of homecoming in Washington, D.C. And so AJ traveled up there to D.C. Yes. and operated this steam-powered sawmill right there on the mall. Mm. And it was quite a sight to see.
But, and I'm sure he wasn't the only one of those people that grew up in the agricultural environment and had all kinds of expertise in different areas like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Tell us about red clay.
Well, it's one of the sites that is very important in its commemoration. Like Fort Pillow had a tremendously important disaster, military disaster there. And red clay, of course, represents the removal of Cherokee. And it wasn't one of the removal fort sites, but it was the last of the gathering places where the Cherokee had Georgia rule that no Indians could gather. So a lot of their very early gathering places, socio-religious, political gathering places in Georgia couldn't be used. So red clay was already an old one also at the Big Blue Spring there, but it became the one they really had to use after those Georgia laws changed. So important gathering place, and then the removal forts were kind of all around there. So it represents an awfully important story for Tennessee, because Tennessee ended up with not a square inch of Indian reservation, where a number of other southern states
hadn't thought of that.
North Carolina, of course, has the remnant Cherokees in reservation, and there are others. One of the reservations in Alabama, it's a branch of the Choctaw, I believe, but it was a group that had particularly worked with and fought with Andrew Jackson, and he made sure they had a reservation.
Of here in the east, and exactly.
And when the Cherokees were removed, if they came through central Tennessee, close to where we are now, and one of their major routes did, they had a feeling that they wanted to visit their father at the Hermitage if he was there. And, you know, he circumvented Supreme Court decisions to go ahead and get them removed, but they still felt a closeness with him in some ways.
The Indians did?
Yes.
I've never heard that before, Ward. Tell me more about that.
They expressed that desire to visit the home of their father there.
The Great White Father.
Yes.
Okay.
My goodness. Some of them had fought with him.
Okay, as soldiers.
Well, by his side.
Right. Well, that's extraordinarily interesting. Now, red clay as a place to visit is a very, very pretty place. You mentioned that spring that's there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
One of the prettiest little places in the whole state park system, in my view. Well worth a visit. It's kind of a remote place to get to, though.
Red clay. Yeah, very close to an ancient portage that was extremely important in the eastern United States, where this 11-mile portage, along with only two additional portages, would take you from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico.
All right, so tell me more what you mean exactly.
Well, the Van family and Ross probably, but there were Cherokee families that controlled both ends of the portage and became quite wealthy from that.
So portages from what stream to what stream?
One of them comes off the Ocoee.
Okay.
And Chattahoochee possibly.
Okay.
But the Cherokees developed heavy wagons to transport the goods from one to the other.
Wow.
So there was a portage close to the Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky line, and a portage that coming with a stream going to the Great Lakes, and one coming to the Ohio that still carries that area, has that name, portage. So you came up a river and that portage up in Illinois or Ohio, and then down to into Kentucky, Virginia border, and then eventually to this portage. And the Cherokees had so much experience with that transportation business that when the federal road was built through the Cherokee property, they hired the Cherokee to lay out the road and build through their area. Of course, the Cherokee probably didn't understand how much things were going to change when that road started being heavily used with traffic. But
you and I had a conversation a year or more ago about the Cockrell Spring that's now been unearthed in Centennial Park.
Mm-hmm.
And as it's at the terminus of the Natchez Trace Trail. Fascinating thing that the city has done there to bring that spring up out of the ground.
It's just off of West End.
That's
in
right.
That corner of
that's
Centennial
right.
Park. And it, I haven't seen how far they've gotten with that.
Well, let me just tell you, it's quite a beautiful presentation that they've done there. Lots of landscaping there, but of course that spring lay hidden for many years, decades, and now is up and where people can see it and see why the Natchez Trace began there.
Yes.
Having that spring there was the reason why that trail began there.
Nashville had so many traces coming into it before it even existed. It was an important crossing point, and like the interstates coming in from six directions now, it had old tracks and traces and trails coming in from all those directions. To a great extent because of the salt lick, concentration of animals and any migrating animals over many centuries would have crossed at that lick and helped establish trails, and then hunters would be drawn to that, and the Nashville kind of building up from the junction of all those. There was a Nickajack Trace. Are you familiar with
Tell me more. I think this is what our conversation was about a year or so ago, and I was so intrigued.
Rather than slightly southwest like the Natchez, this went a little bit more to the southeast.
Okay.
So close to the route of 41 in some places. Then it shifts away from it in Murfreesboro, and there's a late 1700s map that shows it from Captain Lynch's in Murfreesboro, then extending out to what became Bradyville Road for a while, and the springs along that are marked. But then it reaches the foothills of the Highland Rim, and a transportation phenomena that was going on at that time, a shift that started to take place probably with how much wagon use there was. As roads started to go up along valley to access higher ground, but earlier they had gone up the first opportunity of a ridge sticking out. So it went to what was called the foot of the Tennessee Ridge and went up and then followed this ridge top. That's a really interesting route to take if you're coming out of Manchester, because this does lead to Manchester close to the old stone fort before it goes on south. But you drive out across the Highland Rim, which looks very flat, and suddenly at a place called Fudge Around. Have you ever been there?
I've never been there.
You have to go through Hoodoo. You'll see Hoodoo on the map. Fudge Around is not, but it is an old name. But after Hoodoo and then Fudge Around, you go from flatland to the land drops tremendously off to both sides of you when you're on the ridgetop.
Okay.
With big views off in the distance into that one. What's the mountain that's the highest spot on the Highland Rim that's a remnant of the Cumberland Plateau? We're getting too old.
Yes.
But just to go from that flat land of the Highland Rim to suddenly be on that ridgetop without changing elevation.
You're speaking of the property that has recently just been brought into state ownership, and I can't remember which property it is.
It's close to the point where that Highland Rim narrows down to go out on that ridge. Actually, two trails met and went out on the ridge, and that's where there was a Fort Nash. Not
okay.
Nashboro, but
okay.
Nash,
okay.
Which was 1801 to 1806 with 4th Regiment U.S. Infantry. and it was their job to patrol the frontier. There was the military boundary line between what's now Murfreesboro and Manchester, and no settlers could go beyond that line. So it was their job, which would be about as tough as working back and forth.
We're talking about Short Mountain? Is that what we're talking about? Short Mountain. I knew I would come up with it after.
Yeah, I gave you time.
But, that property has recently been brought into the state ownership. Seems like there was, if I'm correct about it, some drug dealer had owned the property, and it was seized as part of the prosecution of this criminal thing, and somehow got into state ownership.
Yeah, I'll be anxious to see which piece that was. It would be wonderful if they got the probable site of that old fort. It's the only fort of that period in Tennessee that hasn't been exactly located or archaeologically located. Kevin Smith worked on one, Fort Blunt, at a river crossing, and you know Hiawassee Garrison in East Tennessee. But this one patrolled the area just south of there, and if any settlers came in, they were kicked out. And that's where a soldier's job gets tough, like you were talking about a park manager's job earlier.
Right, right.
Sometimes their orders were to tear everything down, burn the crops, just destroy it all,
just
and
because
get
they
them
didn't
out.
Want
and they
there.
Tell them, oh, back off a little bit, you know. Right. And their orders would kind of go back and forth on how severe to be, which just reminds me of trying to operate in Iraq or of Afghanistan with among some friends, some not, and
trying to
walking
figure
all
out
these lines.
Exactly.
But in 1806, that line was opened up and settlers could go beyond there.
So, Ward, were you, switching gears here just a little bit, were you involved in the foundation of the this new Rocky Fork area?
No.
But you're from way up in East Tennessee, so you're familiar with it.
Yeah, probably. I was very interested in that and love who they got for the manager.
Not a person I know.
Jesse Germain.
Okay.
I'm not sure the pronunciation of the last name, but he's doing a wonderful job up there. And it's an interesting approach. It was the largest piece of land that left that could have been acquired for public use. And it's not all park, but it's, 46,000 acres or more?
Let's tell our listeners where that is exactly.
Unicoi County, not far from Irwin. There is a little community of Unicoi. But along the Tennessee-North Carolina line, where there is a bulge to the south in the line, and this fills a lot of that and runs back towards Irwin. And it runs back close to where the Nolichucky River cuts through the mountains and then comes on out into Tennessee. But that land is divided between TWRA and forestry, and then a core of park land to help use the other public lands that it's connected to. But it's a giant swath of public land now, with Rocky Fork being the base for use of it.
My recollection is that there's a cultural aspect to that site as well, with an early contact with the Spanish. Is that?
Yes. That is very close to the route that DeSoto came in. There's an archaeologist at East Tennessee State now, Jackson, that has been studying it, thinking he might be on the site that they talked about first camping and making contact with Native Americans when they came into what's now Tennessee, which may put it very close to Johnson City.
Right.
But it's in that general area. They were following the Nolichucky. And that wasn't known for many years. They thought he came in further south and wasn't in Tennessee as long. But then with some new translations, people that had
speaking
studied
of DeSoto it, and his
there were like seven journals, but many people that researched that route over the years were using journals that weren't that well translated, and certainly not translated by people that understood multiple languages, including Native American languages. So there had been some retranslation work, and they were able to find that the descriptions of Pardo, who did come in up there, were actually describing the same places that DeSoto was describing. So DeSoto had come in the route that Pardo later used. So that located it far to the north and puts him in Tennessee, like north-south angled from one end to the other there. So that's a very good story for them to get into. But then there was also an attack on a camp of Chickamauga Cherokee, I believe, tucked back in the valleys of Rocky Fork. Might turn out to be a controversial one, though.
To tell the story might be controversial?
The people attacking wanted to blame them for some tax where they were getting revenge. But that's less than clear.
Okay.
And other people see this as just an outright massacre of that Native American camp. I don't know where we are on trying to tell that story right now.
It's interesting. It brings recollections of the issues we had in interpreting what happened at Fort Pillow. On what side you're on in that discussion.
Yes, and we can do another podcast just on that if you like someday.
Of course, what happened at Fort Pillow was the massacre of a lot of black soldiers. Who were fighting for the Union,
right?
And not a good story, no matter who's responsible.
Yeah, very high casualty rate, and much higher among the African American soldiers than among the white Union soldiers.
Right. So Ward, what does your future hold? What do you? I know you're retired now. What are you going to be doing in your retirement?
Well, writing sounds good, but my day-to-day is fairly typical. You know, there's a little bit of brunch or biscuit somewhere, and then walk at the Bicentennial Mall, and go home and do a little posting. The way I use social media is like a magazine, or that's Depression-era photography, which is an interest in cultural resource and archaeology news. And
I do enjoy seeing your posts on your Facebook.
Thank
on your
you.
Facebook page. And you are a music fan, I know.
Yeah, almost half nights of the week, I guess, I get out to some good shows. It's not hard to get to some good shows. And I live in East Nashville, and there's a lot over there. And I don't go to a lot of bigger venue shows and expensive ones, but there's a lot. Some of the other shows are just as good, really. We have so much talent here.
Was your family involved in music historically?
I have a couple of instruments that came out of the family, but no, certainly not in the days of beginning to record music, which, you know, the Bristol Sessions was about the beginning
exactly.
of the recording. But I have a fretless five-string banjo that came out of the Weems family, and then there was a fiddle that came out of my mother's family. Her father was William Faulkner, the real William Faulkner, not the writer.
My goodness.
Not the writer. A grandfather in that family had this fiddle, and my daughter has taken on the fiddle playing in the family now. Two children grew up on Tennessee State Parks, and now one lives in the middle of New York City, and the other lives in the middle of Los Angeles.
Oh, my.
But the guitarist is in New York, and Lindsay is in Los Angeles. And Wes played guitar a lot around town here a lot, but he has a very intense job in New York now. He works for the Bowery Commission, takes care of the homeless in New York, and is very good at it. And Lindsay has done some acting and dancing and various things in Los Angeles, but she's settled into some very high-level Pilates instruction and is in a good place to do that in her fiddle playing.
Excellent. Well, Ward, we've really appreciated your time today and the time that you've spent with us. Wish you luck in your career. Maybe we'll have you back to talk about some of these other subjects that we didn't get into.
Love to do it.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.